This is Andrew Cate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Harrison Ford befriends a CGI dog in The Call of the Wild, while Nicolas Cage flashes back to his early career in the trippy Color Out of Space.
Oh, this is going to be a fun one, isn't it, Andrew? Let's start with Chris Sanders' Call of the Wild, which is obviously adapted from the Jack London adventure novel that you pretended to read in middle school and submitted a book report anyway, Ryan. It centers around this giant St. Bernard-type dog named Buck and his trajectory from being a plantation dog all the way from there to being sold into basically being a sled dog up in the Yukon Territory in Alaska and during the Gold Rush era, and then eventually Harrison Ford's sidekick. It's kind of a throwback to those 90s family action adventure movies that, like, it's just so emotional, hard on its sleeve, so on the nose, so matter of fact, so grandiose, so overdramatic. And it has a weird CGI dog in the front that, you know what, I was a dog guy and I was high as a kite when I saw this, so I kind of enjoyed myself, to be honest. There's Andrew just kind of shook his head at me. It's really, you know, it is what it is, and I tend to enjoy these kinds of things if I just go with it and I appreciate it for what they're trying to do. And to that end, they are wildly successful, although I do think it was telling that there were more senior citizens in my theater than there were little kids. I think that, this is definitely playing to an older crowd. It definitely has that old school adventure feel to it too, which I appreciated, and does set up some really fun set pieces. The CGI overall, I mean, aside from the dog itself, like, kind of looking out of place amongst all these humans, the landscapes, and this was shot by Janusz Kaminski, who is actually Steven Spielberg's go-to guy, but just the landscapes that are created, you know, through CGI enhancement and the natural lighting and the framing from Kaminski, it really is a surprisingly very good-looking movie in a lot of ways. And, you know, some of the other animals are rendered, you know, the camera doesn't linger on them long enough for you to notice the imperfections maybe that you would with Buck, but I think they probably did the best they could with Buck. And, you know, just kind of seeing, knowing that what the actors had to pull off, considering I'm sure everyone kind of saw the behind the scenes featurette where it's basically a guy on all fours in a motion capture suit playing Buck. So for actors like Harrison Ford, Omar Sy, Dan Stevens, Bradley Whitford, all, like, just kind of interacting with this animal, it almost, with the exception of maybe Bradley Whitford, you believe that they're actually interacting with a dog. So a credit to those actors, especially in some of the more emotional moments. But this is, at the end of the day, the elevation that this movie really got was from Harrison Ford. You know, I did kind of appreciate Dan Stevens' performance as that mustache twirling villain, that one-dimensional, oh, it's the Gold Rush, I need my treasure. I was entertained by that and just kind of accepted it for what it was. Harrison Ford gave this a kind of gravitas that it didn't necessarily deserve or earn, but, you know what, it actually worked and it did elevate it for me. And there were just so many, like, genuinely sad moments throughout, even as, you know, aside from me being a dog lover, there's just, like, some uncomfortable moments towards the end, and then something that almost kind of hits you in the heart. It's really weird how this movie kind of works itself and presents itself, but at the end of the day, I don't know, I just kind of went with it.
So I'm definitely not as high on it, pardon the pun, as Ryan is with this film. I think it's definitely of the middle of the road variety. It is surprising to see, like, Harrison Ford just melt into a role so naturally like this, especially because, as Ryan stated, he was acting opposite a guy on all fours. And I think everyone knows Harrison Ford at this point could care less, could give two shits about most things in general. He's one of the great underrated interviews out there because he just clearly just doesn't care and just has this sort of wry sense of humor, for sure. And, you know, this is the first time he's been number one on the call sheet in quite some time. Obviously, with him sort of returning to iconic roles, it's not surprising that he can bring gravitas to that. But for a wholly sort of original role, at least for him, you know, his first take on it, it's surprising to see that. And I thought he was easily the element I enjoyed most. Without him in this film, I'll be honest, I probably wouldn't have enjoyed much of it, if any of it. And as far as Ryan talking about the dogs, look, I'm a dog person as well, but as far as I'm concerned, there isn't a single freaking dog in this movie. There are CGI aliens posing as dogs, okay? And look, I do agree that the CGI is impressive for the environments. That is incredibly impressive, although I've always been someone who will stand on the side of these battle lines forever. I will always say Kaminski is overrated. High to hell. I think there's so many, you know, better cinematographers working. I'm not saying he doesn't have his bright spots, and I do think there are some striking shots in this, but I think it all comes down to the work of the CGI. And I think it's really unfortunate that while, you know, And they basically create, that's crazy. They didn't shoot this on location. They shot this, as Harrison Ford said, in California, and they just created these entire environments wholesale, and that's impressive. And yes, Kaminsky adds a bit of light to it. And I do think, you know, I think the other animals are fine, like the wolves. I think they look natural enough. But yeah, my biggest problem is the dog. Like the opening sequence alone, I feel like I was like back in the, you know, you said the 90s. I felt like I was back watching one of these terrible Scooby-Doo movies that James Gunn was a part of. Like it was like the face on the dog. It was just so ridiculous and so cheesy. And I'll be the first one to admit, look, these family drama type of things, they're not for me. Look, if I was a kid, maybe I'd enjoy it more, but I just couldn't go with it to that degree, at least particularly in the first half. You know, like I said, once Harrison Ford becomes a large part, and it was actually surprising to me how he was a small part of the film, and then he didn't really become a large part of it until sort of mostly the second half, but he did surprisingly have gravitas, and like we mentioned, it's really crazy that he actually committed to this role when he's not even acting opposite a dog, but he actually makes you genuinely care for this relationship between himself and this CGI alien creature. But, you know, like I said, it's surprising. Like, I do think some of the visuals are quite breathtaking, and that's just a credit to the visual effects work on display. You mentioned Dan Stevens, who's one of my, he's always been one of my, you know, sort of favorite actors in recent years. I first came to know him when I watched the first few seasons of Downton Abbey. Then I really grew an appreciation for him in films like The Guest, and then I really fell in love with him on the show Legion, which is a really, really great show. Here, my biggest issue is, look, I think the performance is fine for what they're going for. I just think it's the exact cliche subplot that you expect in this movie. He's someone, he's searching, he wants gold above all else, and nothing else matters, nothing else cares. Yes, I'm gonna beat these CGI alien creatures posing as dogs. Yes, I don't care about Karen Gillan, who for some reason shows up a second in this movie and then disappears despite being a very enjoyable screen presence, and she's nowhere to be found, you know, after one scene that she's in. I just don't understand, you know, what they're going for at certain points, and I don't think it ever truly coalesces into something truly meaningful. There are very genuine moments between Harrison Ford and this CGI creature in the second half of the film, and like I said, I think he brings a lot of heart to it, which is unexpected from Harrison Ford. But overall, for me, I just don't think it ever coalesced into something more meaningful, you know, than it was. And also, I have to bring up something that was baffling to me. You know, you bring up, you know, Jack London. I honestly don't think I've ever read anything by Jack London. Maybe it was blocked in my memory from back in the day in school, but I have no recollection because I know his famous, you know, novels and stories and stuff, and I don't think I ever had the fortune of reading one of his stories, you can even say that. But I was baffled by this one element in this film where there were our central dog, Buck, if you can call him a dog, you know, has his own spirit dog or spirit wolf, and I was just completely confused of, well, what is this? So this is meant to be, is this his call of the wild? Is that really how on the nose they're being with this? And I know I shouldn't have expected much more from this, and it sounds like I'm much more passionately negative on this film than I am. I think it's perfectly middle of the road, although, like I said, in the first part of the movie I was like already checked out. I was like I get bad secondhand embarrassment sometimes, and the opening sequence of this film gave me some of the worst I've had in a theater. It certainly doesn't compare to Cats in any way, but you know what I mean. It's sort of, you know, it just has just too much. I just felt like in a world with the great visual effects house like Weta, in a world where Andy Serkis is doing amazing work as a CGI ape, they can and they should do better.
Yeah, that was fair enough on that point. But, you know, the wolf served a purpose, Andrew. That was his call of the wild. I thought that was clear. but they, you know, it's obviously this movie at the end of the day, there's this voiceover narration from Harrison Ford that just kind of explains that this movie is supposed to be from the dog's perspective. And there are a lot of like little weird scenes where Buck is just kind of sitting there staring at characters, and Harrison Ford's narration comes in and kind of fills in the blank of what Buck might actually be thinking in that moment. And a lot of times, yes, when even though we didn't necessarily need to hear that, he is explaining that as he's staring at this, as Buck is staring at this hallucinatory giant black insanity wolf that's following him around and giving him, you know, slight nods of encouragement for him to run a little bit faster across the ice, save the mailman's wife under, I mean, it's just like there's, and you know, that is actually one thing I'll give the film credit for. You mentioned that the opening scene on the, obviously on the plantation, yeah, that was goofy as hell, and no one's gonna fault you for calling that out, but I think some of the set pieces were actually fairly solid, especially that aforementioned ice chase. And, you know, even this scene where he's in a canoe with Harrison Ford, or, yeah, a canoe, and they're kind of going down the rapids. And there are a lot of, you know, scenes where the dog inexplicably cheats death, but you hate to be reductive about it, but that's just the call of the wild, man. And you're either with it or you're not. Like, the movie just doesn't make any sense whatsoever at the end of the day. But they wrung enough emotion out of it and seen, and obviously a lot of that's credit to Harrison Ford, but they wrung emotion out of it in a lot of ways that make me wonder if they shifted focus more towards Harrison Ford's character, it would have been better. But then again, that wouldn't be Call of the Wild. Call of the Wild is about the dog. The dog finds his happiness at the end of the film, despite, you know, coming through tragedies along the way. I don't know. There was just something about seeing the dog going off into the wild. No, who the hell am I kidding? It's fucking weird. But you know what? It doesn't matter. For 2 hours, I just kind of turned off my brain. And I can't explain it any better than that. I just went with it. Sometimes, you know, even like picturing the cast and crew on set filming this, like just, you know, in between takes, and you could picture Harrison Ford just kind of repeating lines and doing takes with some of this stuff. That pulls me out of the movie and pulls me back a little bit and makes me appreciate the work behind it a little bit more. So when you see that sincerity on Harrison Ford's face, you can appreciate it that much more, and you actually come to admire him a little bit more as an actor. He hasn't really, you know, you mentioned this is his first starring role, and God only knows how long. I think we pinned it back to, what was it, Firewall, which was like 2006 or something like that. I didn't see it. I pretty much checked out on Harrison Ford stars after Hollywood Homicide. But, you know, you forget what this guy is actually capable of. Obviously, he was Han Solo recently, and Indiana Jones is probably coming up again soon. But I don't know. This is, Harrison Ford saves this movie and gives it legitimacy, and it gives me a firm foot to stand on when I can say with a straight face that I had fun with it.
Yeah, and look, I don't like blame you too much for having, you know, that take, but I think you're right. If it leaned a bit more on Harrison Ford, it would have been more effective. Because, like I said, I think he's the real strength of this film, and without him, I don't think it would have much going for it at all. And they have like a sort of slight subplot with him and sort of his family, which obviously we don't see, but we sort of get like a slight sense of what he's going through and his penchant for being just a drunk, you know, by himself, you know, hanging out in the woods. And, you know, I do think there was scenes, and, you know, my biggest problem, like I said, I think the CGI really held back the dog subplot, because there's, like, this whole sequence, like, in the first half where we have, like that I think would have potential if they got the CGI work right, where we have the dog essentially battling for leader of the pack or something, you know, and I think there's, yes, it's a cliche idea, but I think, you know, there was some visual stuff in there that I think it could have made it much more effective, but the thing holding it back was the CGI of the dogs, and like I said, they're just hard to buy into completely, and that was my biggest problem with the film. I was never able to completely buy into the journey being told from Buck's perspective, because, like I said, I didn't buy into him being a dog and being more of just a CGI alien creature. But credit to Harrison Ford, it's nice to see him care again on the big screen. But safe to say, I think Ryan certainly recommends this one more than I do. But I think you probably know whether this is for you or not based on the trailer. If family, you know, family-friendly type of films aren't your thing, you know, you can certainly do better, but I guess you also could do worse, for sure, especially with a lot of the family-friendly direct that's constantly being put out there in theaters. But with that in mind, we're going to transition to a couple of different news stories, and it makes for an easy transition. You know, Ryan name-dropped Indiana Jones, and yes, they are making another Indiana Jones after Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which, you know, I will not defend as a good movie. I will say that I don't think it's quite as bad as a lot of people think it is. I think it was one of those things where I went to the theater and there was so much negativity already swirling around it that when I saw it, I was like, oh, you know what? You know, sometimes it all comes from is what you're thinking when you go into it. And if you're expecting something really bad, it might not completely live up to those, you know, lower expectations, you know. But what's interesting is certainly there were some definitely creatively bankrupt decisions. And I've talked about previously on this podcast of how I think a lot of modern Spielberg just doesn't hold the same magic, but that's not to discredit for some of the collection of amazing films he made earlier in his career, for sure. But the latest news that broke this week is that, you know, Spielberg, yes, this was happening. I know a lot of people don't know about it, probably because, you know, a lot of the wind was sucked out of the franchise after Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, was that Spielberg was actually signed on to direct Indiana Jones 5 later this year, but apparently late this past week, news was dropped that he is dropping coming out, and James Mangold has been the rumored replacement. Of course, Mangold is coming off of, you know, Ryan's treasured Ford versus Ferrari. But this guy, you know, James Mangold is someone who has an interesting career, because I think he has made some really good stuff, and then he's made some other stuff that isn't quite good. I think a film that is really underrated is 310 to Yuma, his remake, a 310 to Yuma starring Christian Bale and Russell Crowe in a really great, one of his best roles, honestly, for my money. And, you know, that's a really underrated Western for sure. Obviously, the Logan is obviously one that he really pulled off with steam. But then there's others that never really completely coalesced into a meaningful whole. You know, I feel like he is like, he's such an easy choice to fill in for this, because he is that sort of, he's sort of that middle of the road filmmaker. Sometimes he can make something really good. Sometimes he just takes a step back. So I really, it's not like I'm greatly anticipating this next indie film. Who the hell is going to be in it outside of Harrison Ford? Who the hell knows? But I'm sure they could do worse, you know, than Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, I guess. But we'll see. You know, I don't have high hopes for it, but it is what it is at this point, I guess.
This basically, in my head, while you were saying all that, I was kind of working out this, like, James Mangold human centipede of this episode, where not only did he direct Ford versus Ferrari, which is another old-timey adventure, you know, kind of a throwback to, like, the 96-97 level Oscar bait, he will be directing a throwback franchise that should have died back in 1989 where it fucking belonged, but he was also the producer on Call of the Wild.
Wow, and that's a great connection. I forgot I saw his name pop up in those end credits, for sure. But yeah, it's safe to say neither of us are greatly anticipating this next indie film, although I am a big fan of the original trilogy, at least. But another big break in the movie world this week was the trailer dropped for a film that we've name-checked, you know, a few different times over the course of the past couple months on this podcast, for The Candyman. It's hard to call it, you know, a remake, sequel, reimagining. It's sort of all of those things, apparently. We don't know exactly what to expect. We know that Tony Todd is returning. It hasn't been completely spelled out that he is playing Candyman himself, but I'd assume there's going to be some version of him to that regard. But the trailer dropped this week, and I thought it was really fantastic. You know, this is hailing from, obviously, producer Jordan Peele, and also a filmmaker who I shared my thoughts on her last film in our catch-up episode for 2019, a film called Little Woods. And she's directing this. We have, I'm going to butcher his name, but Yahya Abdul-Mateen, who played the villain in Aquaman, but also had a killer role for anyone who saw Watchmen this past fall. He absolutely had a killer role on that and really delivered the goods in that. So it's great to see him on screen. We also have a returning character from the original, played by Vanessa Williams. We have, you know, a few other actors in there. I'm blanking on her name, but I'll always know her from her supporting role on Mad Men. But, you know, it's really interesting. You know, the trailer does this weird thing where it, you know, obviously it does the classic thing where it's sort of like, you know, it's sort of the Candyman is sort of a version of Bloody Mary, where it's like you say his name, you know, five times in a mirror and then he appears. And I was fortunate enough, I finally watched the original this past Halloween season. And man, is it really underrated. Virginia Madsen, Xander Berkeley sort of star in this one alongside of Vanessa Williams. And it also has this iconic score from Philip Glass that is hard to get out of your head after watching the film. And what's cool about the trailer for this update is that it combines Destiny's Child of all things with that classic Philip Glass score, and I thought it really worked greatly. I'm really pumped about the trailer. I think it really has, you know, it looks like it could be some fun. Yes, the bees are back. No, Nick Cage, we're not talking about those bees, but I'm really pumped. You know, I think Candyman is really underrated, at least the first film is. I know the sequels are not as beloved, although I haven't seen any of them, but I highly recommend, if you haven't seen the original, to check it out, because this looks like one that might be one of the more memorable horror updates. Although we've had good luck with them, I guess, in recent years, to say the least.
Yeah, for every, you know, Child's Play remake, there's a David Gordon Green's Halloween, basically. So I think just even by law of averages, this was due to be good. But that trailer was really, really solid. I haven't seen the original in full in a very long time. I went back and rewatched maybe the first half hour of it at Halloween before I got distracted by something else, of course. But yeah, the trailer actually looked like it was going to be scary, which I appreciate. And, you know, I kind of appreciate the fact that they're modernizing it and taking that Halloween approach where they're going back to what actually makes it scary in the first place, instead of trying to go too far out into left field and just All right, so even going back to maybe like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake from like 2003 at the height of torture porn, instead of trying to keeping up with current trends, like things like that, I did mention Child's Play already. I didn't want to go back to that well again, just trying to show a point of comparison. I don't know. When Slasher is done right, it's like super entertaining, and I appreciate that, especially with Candyman. It's a story that's used to say something that's a little bit different than what you get from the, you know, well, even really anything.
Yeah, for sure. But let's just say, you know, I'm excited to see Tony Todd back on the screen. Hopefully, you know, like we said, we don't know exactly what his role. Obviously, I think that's purposeful. But you would have to assume he is some version of Candyman in this. But, you know, I'm definitely excited to see what comes of it. And with the unique producing capabilities of Jordan Peele, especially based on his two recent directorial efforts, I'm sure it'll have some unique social commentary, to say the least, which obviously harkens back to the original Candyman as well. But now we're going to turn our attention to our second film in this episode, and boy, what a film we have to discuss here. This is Richard Stanley's Color Out of Space, and it's the latest. It's dropped pretty much everyone could. Well, it dropped out. I saw it like on DVD in Walmart. It dropped on Redbox. It's out on demand on iTunes now, which is the way I watched it, but it's all over the place now. And this is one that's actually gotten quite a good critical reception, which is surprising to me because while I definitely enjoyed it, it just definitely feels like of the divisive variety. It's one of these sort of indie horror-esque type films that your mileage certainly may vary, but me, being the Nick Cage accolade I am, I definitely enjoyed it. You know, I watched this last night, and I felt like after I was like, felt like half my face was melted off. It was certainly not an experience I'll soon forget. But essentially, it centers on, you know, this sort of family. They essentially live, you know, essentially it's adapted from a short story from H.P. Lovecraft, which I'll talk about some of my connections to this a bit later, but it's adapted from a short story from H.P. Lovecraft, you know, whose work has always been in the public domain, so it's always easy to take up. But this is not one of the stories that I was overly familiar with, but essentially it centers around this family who lives sort of essentially on in a farmhouse, you know, out in the middle of the woods, you know, and, you know, the titular dad is played by Nick Cage, and it starts really interestingly in normal dad mode, which is not what you expect from Nick Cage, but don't worry when we get to the craziness later on this film. And then we have the mother played by Jolie Richardson, and then we have a trio of kids that fill out the ensemble. And essentially what happens is this pinkish sort of meteorite type of thing crash lands, and then literally this pinkish color starts to take over, and it's never quite fully explained, which I actually appreciate. I like that they never really fully explained what was happening, but safe to say this family starts to act strange. You know, the water seems to be contaminated in some way. We also have this daughter who is into Wiccan rituals. She reads the Necronomicon for pleasure, apparently. And it definitely has a lot of those weird touches, for sure. We have Tommy Chong playing, you know, someone who like, sits on the property in a little shack. And clearly in Cheech and Chong mode, for sure. But it's nice to see him pop up here and there. But essentially, the film unravels. And like I said, it sort of starts with sort of eases you into this sense of normalcy with the family, with sort of just some cliche dialogue lines, particularly early on, for sure, in terms of, oh, you know, I'm your dad, you know. don't speak like that, sort of stuff like that. But I understand what the film was doing, you know, at a certain point, because when things unravel, you sort of get the sense, oh, so that's what they're going for. Then they just want to completely unravel this family. You know, there's some weird touches in here where Nick Cage has this obsession with his farm's alpacas, and he enjoys milking them, which I didn't even know that was a thing, weirdly enough. I mean, he greatly enjoys, you know, after offering, you know, his milk to this local surveyor who's looking into the water situation, and he slurps down a nice cup of alpaca milk, which is always interesting to say the least. But what I enjoyed, of course, I enjoyed Nick Cage in this film. You know, like I said, he starts a bit normal, but then sort of midway through the film, he sort of starts to, like I alluded to in the introduction to this podcast, he starts to take on some of the traits of some of the characters early on in his career, particularly his performance, and extremely underrated. If you haven't seen it, you gotta watch this. It might be the most batshit movie Nick Cage has ever made, Vampire's Kiss. There's a bit of a twang. People who have seen the film or have seen the clips on YouTube, which is the way most people have seen these iconic scenes, you know, you'll get a clear sense of that. And I always love, you know, that's what I love about Nick Cage. He is truly the California Klaus Kinski, as he likes to say. He likes to really go for these things without any intention. And you can tell that Richard Stanley, at a certain point, just let him off the leash and then just said, Nick Cage, go and do your thing.
And that might actually be part of the problem I have with the movie. I was not as big of a fan of this as a lot of people were, and it's not, and so I guess I'll start by saying the movie does get into a lot of body horror stuff, and that's one of the few things on camera that I'm pretty squeamish about for some reason. I don't have any psychological explanation for it. So to that end, the movie is actually pretty effective, and there's some great prosthetics that they use later on in the film without getting into spoilers. There are some really gooey surprises that pop up later on. But you know, you're right. He just lets Nick Cage off in Nick Cage mode, and I think unless Nick Cage is in a movie like Mandy, for instance, from a couple years ago, the rest of the movie struggles to keep up with him. And I think a lot of the problem that I also have with the movie is that it feels too, like, it could have benefited from a tighter structure. I think there are too many characters that really are completely uninteresting and don't really serve any purpose. You mentioned that surveyor, and the shout out to Providence, obviously. It was cool that he's from there. The movie does take place in Massachusetts, played by a British actor named Elliot Knight. Just really, you know, it starts with his voiceover and ends with his voiceover, and it just doesn't really, like, it's a weird tone to set. And we have that, this kind of, the score by Colin Stetson. Colin Stetson is a fantastic musician. He's played with Arcade Fire, and he also put out an album with Sarah Neufeld. It was like this weird kind of new agey classical piece. So if you're a fan of the score, definitely check out that album. Very, very highly recommended. In the context of this film, I think it's serviceable, but it is also kind of jarring because it doesn't even necessarily match up with the visuals. The visuals do get very psychedelic, and they're very interesting, and there's a lot of really beautiful framing and use of color. You know, obviously it's called Color Out of Space, so it's a neon hellscape in some scenes, but even just like certain shots of Nick Cage and Jolie Richardson on the porch with the lights going around earlier on in the movie, and they're just kind of embracing in there. There's just like some very striking imagery, and Stanley, who I looked him up, the only thing that I had seen that I'm even remotely familiar with was that he was the screenwriter for The Island of Dr. Moreau. This film does share a little bit of the DNA of The Island of Dr. Moreau. But at the end of the day, there was just something that felt like too lackadaisical and nonsensical. You mentioned the daughter with the Necronomicon and doing all these weird Wiccan rituals, and even the movie kind of goes into one of those in the beginning, and it kind of sucked me out. I feel like if you just had Nick Cage and Jolie Richardson and you stuck on them, maybe keep the creepy youngest kid in there and just go from there, everything else just really diverted my attention, and it wasn't necessarily in a, you know, like stoner super cool, like fascinating way. It was more just like it was pulling my attention away from what I think was the most effective parts of the movie.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that, honestly. Like I said, I like the film. I'm not in love with the film. I think there are certainly flaws to the film, like you sort of called out and mentioned specifically. But yeah, like for me, like I said, I'm someone who craves just these weird experiences, and this film definitely delivered that. And that's why I think, you know, people, your mileage may vary. It'll be more divisive. You'll sort of, like we talked about the Call of the Wild, something completely different, but I think you'll know whether this is for you or not heading in. But yeah, I loved the visual nature of the film. Like I thought, you know, just, I don't know, it was just a unique concept where there's this sort of like I said, it's sort of, it doesn't ever is fully explained, but there's some essentially coming on this meteorite, there's some alien type of force, although we never get a clear sense of that, which I, like I said, I don't mind. You know, that's sort of a big part of a lot of Lovecraft stories where it's sort of the unexplained. But I love just sort of the pinkish tint that it takes on. The character starts to experience like losses of time, which I think was one of the elements that I think they could have gone further with, because it was just sort of like mentioned by the kids and then it was never sort of followed up on. So there's definitely a lot of weird things, but yeah, I do enjoy the body horror stuff. So I really enjoyed some of the creature work, which I say to say we set up the alpacas, safe to say there's a payoff with that. There's this weird thing with the cat and the family dog. There's all sorts of weird stuff in that, which I could definitely go for, but Ryan's just shivering over here, so I certainly understand that perspective as well. There's also weird things like the youngest son, you know, within this family. There's like this weird sequence where he's like just creepily laughing and talking to this seemingly unseen force. You know, I'm here for it, honestly. But I do agree that I don't think all these elements connect, but I do think that's essentially what the film was going for, was that it was just, like I said, sets up this normal family and then something unexplained happens and things sort of descend from there. And you called out the surveyor and how we have him sort of starting the film and ending the film and having his voiceover sort of as the bookend to the film. I will say, I think that's one of the the things that comes from a trait common in a lot of Lovecraft stories. And I mentioned and teased earlier on that I have a bit of connection to Lovecraft. You know, I mentioned that most of his work is in the public domain. And me and a group of friends years ago, we got together and we said, oh, we're all going to adapt like a short from H.P. Lovecraft. And I actually really enjoyed the process of it. And a lot of there's references in this to the classic, you know, Arkham, Massachusetts, which is where the name Arkham comes from within the Batman universe as well, comes from these Lovecraft stories. But there's always references to that. And I remember typing up my own version and adapting a weird Lovecraft story. And a lot of his stories are like unexplainable. Like you'll read them and you'll have a hard time being like, all right, so what exactly is going on here? You know, and it'll never be completely spelled out, which is something I enjoy. But I certainly understand that for some people, there will be a bit more frustration to that rather than just enjoying and letting it wash over you. So I can't blame anyone for, you know, not being able to follow it. But I don't think there really is anything specifically to follow, I guess, in that regard. And you mentioned filmmaker Richard Stanley. It's interesting. He's a South African filmmaker. And yeah, I was looking through his filmography and I haven't seen any of his stuff at all. But, you know, it's interesting to see this unique filmmaker. Like I said, this is produced by Elijah Wood and Spectre Vision, as we teased in our episode earlier this week. So it's interesting that sometimes they just let these filmmakers and just throw out a crazy experience for you. And like I said, I went with it. You know, I liked it. I'm not in love with the film. It's not perfect in any regard. But I think you can definitely do a lot worse for a Friday night if you just want to spice things up and have a memorable experience, to say the least. And then one of the last things I wanted to mention is this is also apparently filmed in Portugal, which I found really, really interesting. Like, that's something I've been picking up on with a lot of these on-demand films. Like, when I'm in the theater, I'm not going to sit all there the way through the credits unless there's something meaningful at the end. But with a lot of these on-demand films, I'll cut ahead to the end of the credits and look at, oh, well, I wonder where this was filmed. It's something I've been into lately. And yeah, apparently this was filmed as all thank yous to Portugal, and that was the only location that was listed. So really interesting that they got all these actors together, went to Portugal and filmed, safe to say, something really incredibly trippy.
Oh, God. Obrigado for that one. So I want to talk about Lovecraft for a minute, and I'm going to talk about Lovecraft completely separate from this film, because I think that, and it, as is the case with this film and anyone who's touched some of his properties previously, is that, and I, there is connective tissue here. I'm not going to complain just for the sake of complaining. I just want to forewarn, I just want to throw that out there, that they're reclaiming it and kind of making it their own. When Lovecraft wrote these stories, a lot of them didn't make sense because they were impressionistic feelings that he was getting about the influx of Italians and Puerto Ricans moving to Providence at the time. So that's why a lot of it was nonsensical, because it was just like a vomit of racist emotion. So I think a lot, so because there is that lack of thematic tissue that in these original stories, maybe that's why a lot of these movies can't quite connect the dots all the way together. And you know, for all we know, those these aliens in this movie were probably just trying to colonize Federal Hill or something like that.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because the short story I adapted definitely had some allusions to more like racist tendencies, and obviously I sort of, you know, did away with those, you know. But I think it's something, I think that's what's interesting about the process of adapting the work of a famous name like H.P. Lovecraft. Yes, they lived in a different time. They certainly had controversial views that a lot of people certainly would not agree with in any way, you know, in modern times. So I think that's what's interesting about filmmakers tackling is, or taking some element of it and then just be sort of doing their own impressionistic take on it without sort of capitalizing on or utilizing any of that outdated wordage, to say the least. But yeah, and like I said, I think some people will go for it, some people won't. But like we sort of alluded to with our previous film, I think you'll know whether this is for you or not. If you like to see crazy Nick Cage on screen, you could certainly do worse. You could certainly do better. There's a lot better performances coming from him. But, you know, like I said, I just like seeing him on screen and seeing, you know, him lull you into a false sense of security and then have that throwback to and having some of those vampires kiss tendencies sort of, you know, eke out of him, you know, as the iconic actor that he is. But with that in mind, we can turn our attention to our next episode, where we'll be tackling the newly dropped The Invisible Man, which just dropped in theaters, which I'm really excited to see, as well as another horror property, The Lodge, coming from the directing duo who did Goodnight Mommy, which I wasn't a particularly big fan of, but I know a lot of people definitely were.
Is it just me, or are there like a lot of horror movies in these first few months of the year?
Yeah, I mean, that definitely seems to be the case. And it used to be, like, we always talked about how in the first few months they would drop these really terrible horror movies. But now it's not so much the case. It's more like these really indie, you know, critically acclaimed horror films. I think that just sort of harkens to, you know, the modern era we're living in, where we've talked about and talked about this at length on this podcast, where there's just so many good filmmakers working within this genre and doing different things with it. So I'm really excited. You know, yeah, it used to be just the dumping grounds for these. But, you know, Lee Whannell, I think his last directorial effort we did on this podcast, an Upgrade. So I'm excited to see what he does with The Invisible Man, which has gotten a really good reception. And, of course, starring one of my favorite actresses, Elizabeth Moss.
As always, thank you so much for listening to us, and we'll see you next week.